Grown up in a society where discussing our own sexuality with our family, friends, and peers has been taboo and riddled with misconceptions. Many of us feel shame, guilt, and embarrassment around sexuality and intimacy. We are often unaware of how to engage with our own sexuality in a way that is safe for ourselves and for others. Comprehensive sexuality education goes beyond the mechanics of human biology. It equips us with the tools to navigate our relationships with informed consent and respect for personal boundaries, and helps us develop a better understanding of our own minds and bodies. It can radically reduce incidences of sexually transmitted infections and unintended pregnancies, address the endemic issues of gender-based violence, and enhance our self-expression and sexual well-being. Welcome to Safe Spaces, a four-part series by the Bangalore International Center, in which Dr. Sangeeta Saxena takes us on a deep dive into the realm of sex and sexuality. Dr. Sangeeta is a gynecologist, author, counselor, and activist. She co-founded Enfold India in 2001 to promote gender equity, sexuality, and personal safety education. In this episode, we will plunge into the history of human evolution and trace the origins of gender bias. I am Anisha Tawag, and you're listening to Safe Spaces. I would be very interested to understand, as an individual, when you first experienced yourself as a gendered being.
Yeah, very difficult to say, pinpoint anything. I just always was happy as a girl. There was no time when I didn't want to wear frocks or decorate or wear bindis and earrings and all. As I grew older and into adulthood also, there was no, always, I'm a woman, I'm a girl. But later when I started thinking about it, I would often say to people that I just feel that I'm 60% woman, 40% male. I always had more close male friends than female friends. I can't be that, very delicate, sensitive kind of a female. I can't be that. I became aware of that aspect of me much later, maybe in my 30s, 40s. But as a child, I was a cisgendered girl.
I guess it's also relational, right? Because you see a behavior that strikes you as feminine or more feminine, and you see behaviors that are maybe masculine or more masculine. And then we find the gendered identity also in relation to the people around us.
Oh, certainly, certainly. Yeah. It's like having a shade card with you and trying to match it with the colors available, yeah.
That's such a great analogy also, because it brings in the rainbow.
Yeah, and that's why now you find this whole diversity and terms describing gender identities. Because if I'm given only two colors, if I feel orange inside, you give me red and blue, I will say I'm more red than blue. And then you present me red, pink and yellow, I say I'm more like yellow. And then you say, no, there's yellow and orange and this. Oh yeah, that's me. And I'll try to find more people who are like me, like that. And then we form a group and give ourselves a name.
So you are talking about sexuality as a continuous process, something that involves all of our genetic wiring, all of our senses, as a natural phenomenon. And I think in the animal kingdom, we can all agree that these drives are followed and that the purpose is evolutionary, it's quite clear. And it becomes a bit more complicated when it comes to humans, because we don't only have sex to reproduce. We don't only dress a certain way to attract a mate, or at least we don't think we do. We're also just uncovering who we are in a way. So how do you bring this discussion of sexuality as a natural phenomenon, something that's intended by our genetic makeup to human experience.
It's not that the non-human animals have sex only for reproduction. They also use it for different things. Yeah, and it's quite amazing. Quite amazing. They use it to form bonds. Two male lions who are related to each other will have sex to form a bond so that, yeah, they can take care of a wider territory as two lions, and then the lioness is inside. So the more you explore sexuality and the more you read about how it is there in other non-human animals, plants, the more respectful you would be of this whole sense that we have being sexual. So going back to the perception from all our senses, then touch, right? Then that goes into the brain. And as you know, there are different centers, we call them different centers, where these messages are processed. And then it results as the child grows older. Initially, it may just be a sense of pleasure, like when the child is touching their own genitals, right? They are only experiencing pure pleasure that those nerves are carrying to them. They don't have the capacity of adding any thoughts to it, right? Which is different from when, say, a 16-year-old, a 26-year-old, or even a 60-year-old is touching their own genitals. It is now no longer just the pure sensation from the nerves. It is thoughts, visuals, sounds, right? So it becomes more complex. The experience becomes maybe richer. And then, of course, there can be another person also involved or more people involved. Right, in that whole experience. So the complexity of this increases, but the basic hardwiring is there already from birth, because the genitals are, you know, children are born with the genitals. They only develop further. Yeah. They have the nerves, they have the blood supply. Fetuses have been shown to have erection in the uterus. They have been shown to hold their penises. Of course, it's very difficult to show the clitoris, and it's really difficult for a female fetus to have enough dexterity to find her clitoris. But yeah, she might later on in life, and pretty early also she might, right? The whole process of erection, and I must also say that we tend to segregate these processes, like, oh, erection, ejaculation, wet dreams happen in males. No, excuse me, no. They happen in all sexes. Depending on the structures that are present, they would get more blood supply to them. The nerves there become more sensitive for that duration. And then, of course, there can be a peak when a certain other muscles come into play and there's a release of other hormones and other chemicals. And even babies can masturbate to the point of orgasm.
Wow, babies.
Yes.
That's so interesting.
Yes. So you don't need sexual thoughts as such. The sensation is enough.
Sensation is enough.
Yeah.
We do all have drives as human beings. And it's so interesting that you're talking about the baby as having mostly pure sensation. And then the adolescent and the teenager and the adult having something more than pure sensation. There's thought, there's emotion, there's a much more complex set of experiences. So there is a sort of transformation from just drive or just curiosity to something that's maybe a result of conditioning. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do have thoughts, plenty. but it's not conditioning so much as, again, it's natural. And I'll explain why I'm saying that. So if you look at a child, we say a child under 7 years of age is not capable of committing a crime, because their thought processes and the way to plan and execute something, a crime, we say that it's not developed. Maybe with time we may reduce it a little bit, but certainly we all know that a two-year-old is not capable of actually plotting a murder and going about doing it, yeah, right? So our ability to think also grows as we grow older. So our sexual perception of things is also something that becomes more fine-tuned. small children, 3, 4, 5 year olds, they do explore each other's bodies. But that is not with a sexual intent or sexual thought. It's a part of curiosity. Hey, what's your eye like? Oh, nose? Yeah, yeah. And what's this? Your tummy button? Okay, what's this? Oh, this is different from mine. Oh, what's there? So they will touch with their fingers. They will never put their mouth unless they've been subjected to sexual abuse or they have seen it happening. Because they explore everything, their fingers and all that, they will touch. And they will see, they will playful, curiosity. They will be laughing, they will be giggling, and that's it. But as they grow older and once puberty starts, then the secondary sexual characteristics start. Also, the genitals grow in size, they become more sensitive, they begin to function, of course, the germ cells begin to be made, and nature says, hello, come on now, get them fertilized, right? So the attraction part begins.
Okay.
The sexual attraction.
The reason I also brought up the word conditioning, and maybe there are better words for this, is looking at the sort of history of sexuality. Because when we talk about it in biological terms, it's quite equal. Every kind of body and every kind of sexual development has its place. But we look around us in society and there is a hierarchy, right? Not everyone is allowed to explore their sexuality, or some people are ashamed of it. I think we started talking about that, about the guilt that we have just for experiencing sexual urges or perceiving sexual signals. So can you talk a little bit about this sort of historical conception that we've had of sexuality and how it's maybe changed over time?
Let us distinguish the experience of sexuality, one's own experience from one's own body, mm-hmm. and what one feels. I feel attracted towards this person, whether I'm allowed to even look at that person or touch that person, you know, or express it, that is a different story. That's where what you're talking about, conditioning and all of that comes in. But I'm interested in that initial sensation that you have and you feel attracted towards this person. That sense of attraction and how it is felt would not be different from different sexes, I suppose, though it's not necessary that every individual experience it, because we have asexuality, right? And there also it is nuanced. You may feel romantically attracted or just like a companion, but little more than just a friend.
Yeah.
A little more. So it's like a spectrum, right? But let's talk about attraction between the heterosexual or homosexual attraction. It's very difficult to gauge or to measure this attraction. I'm feeling 10 by 10 attraction. What are you feeling? How do you compare these two? You can't compare.
It's not really quantifiable.
No, it's not. Even colors, we know.
Mm.
We know that women experience more colors than males do. What is red to me? How red is it appearing to me? How red is it appearing to the other person? What I'm trying to say is that it's not a question of comparing.
Yeah.
And trying to see who feels more, who feels less, who is superior, who is inferior in this whole game of sexuality. No, just chill. You are what you are. Enjoy it. Respect the other person. They also have as much right to that pleasure, to that enjoyment, as long as it doesn't hurt or harm the other or impinge on their rights. So have a ball.
So the experiences, yeah, we can leave that to like the songwriters and the poets to describe what the experience feels like. But the history of how we try to maybe regulate, control sexuality, that's something that's relevant to all of us. It's played a role in our evolution as a society.
We do a very compressed version of this, beginning with, say, the state in the jungles. And we have always lived in groups, unlike elephants who may be female groups and the males are like separate, but they're still there, right? Humans have always lived in groups of almost equal number of different the male and the female. Of course, intersex has always existed, that variation. But it cannot be the norm, obviously, because then reproduction won't happen. So we have lived in these groups And within those groups, those, you know, about 100, 150 people living together are quite self-sustaining, meaning they can have children and grandchildren and continue without getting decimated because of inbreeding.
Right.
So that 150 or odd is a number like that.
It's a good number.
So there, what would happen? Puberty was probably around similar times, right? Say 12, 13, though of course now it is occurring earlier. But we can say 11, 12, 13 is the time that puberty would start. A little earlier for females and a little later for males. There wasn't, what we see in the tribal societies, there wasn't any regulation. There wasn't like you have to be married, right? So you explore each other and then there is sex and there are babies and the babies are brought up by the entire group.
Of
course,
the
mother is who is breastfeeding, but if the mother is not there, there are enough women who are lactating at any given point of time who would take care of this baby also.
Wow.
Right? So that's how it was. Now you come to a situation in a city. First and foremost, you have to get food and shelter.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay for it. For that payment, you have to work. And the better the kind of work you do, the more money you will get.
Right.
So we find our 11, 12, 13-year-olds sitting in classrooms. And they stay in classrooms till almost they are 24, 25, doing their PhDs. So that they can land a better job.
Yeah.
Right? And the parents are like, don't think of sex and all that. This is not your age. Actually, it is, but this is not your age. Focus on this, get into a good college so that your job shall be not. So adolescent sexuality is curbed because who is going to take care of the baby? You know, you need to earn money. It's not like, you know, we don't have fruits, nothing. Food is bought.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not like free for all to just pluck and eat and get shelter.
Right.
So even in the agricultural society, it was fine. You would have, my great-grandmother probably got married at 13 years of age. Mm-hmm. 12 years of age. Because in an agricultural society, it was fine. You were big enough to work in the field, grow the food, and fine. If you have children, fine. Right? All the work was happening. But in this shift, what happened from the jungle to the land, and agriculture played a big role over there, is that the ownership of the land went from a group tribal ownership to individual ownership.
Ah.
And the males who were taller, who have more muscle as a percentage of their body weight, they have more muscle and they have more bones for a biological reason, to fight with other males for the female. That is why they have it. Females have enough muscle and enough bones to survive in the jungle. For reproduction, they don't need anything extra.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the males who fight for the female. Like the deer or the lions, they fight for each other. So the males have to grow longer, they are, you know, more muscle. But because they have more muscle, now when it comes to taking the land and ownership of the land, they took it all.
More muscle means more power.
Physical power.
Yeah.
So they took it all. So if you look at the land today in this world, almost 90 to 97% is in the name of men. They own it. And if some women have got it, it's because their husband gave it or their father gave it. They didn't have ancestral, except in some matriarchal societies in the Northeast.
I can imagine that more matrilineal communities have different sort of ownership regulations or customs around land, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the women have control over the community or the family, right? It's more that they are handed down land and it's in their name.
It's more than that, because we work quite closely in Shillong, Meghalaya, with Martin Luther Christian University there. So in the Khasi tribe, it is the youngest girl inherits land, and she is supposed to look after the entire family. It's a male who comes and goes, but with inroads of decision making,
mm-hmm.
and even until quite recently, if the government wanted to make a road through the tribe's land, the council would come, it would be all women who will discuss and say whether you can do it or not. So decision making was there, but with more inroads of other cultures, basically the mainstream Indian cultures there, then everything is getting eroded. And it's getting eroded. But what I was trying to point out is that once the ownership of the land became individual and it was a man's land, he wanted it to go to his sons, right? Because his son is going to do the same thing that he did to his sisters and all, right? No, the land is mine, not yours,
mm-hmm.
right? So he wants to make sure that the land goes to his son. That means I need to now control, I need to have a wife.
Who can bear me this male son.
And no one else's child.
Mm-hmm.
But we are the ones who don't have breeding seasons. We breed throughout the year. So you have to control her throughout the year. Right from the time she starts menstruating until she ends it. Right? So women's sexuality was controlled. And even before that, their survival was controlled. Because now they couldn't just go to any land and pluck the fruit over there. Now the fruit tree was growing on somebody's land. It was not hers to take, unlike the forest.
So there was a moment in history when we started to have this concept of ownership, but also of settling.
Mm.
Because we weren't necessarily nomadic, we weren't hunter-gatherers. And it's so interesting to think that that aligned with or maybe even gave rise to more control of sexuality.
Yeah. And see, even the words we use, you said hunter-gatherers. Why put hunter first? We were gatherer-hunters. So over time, because of this control on women's sexuality, their survival, they were not allowed to go out of the home, so they were not educated. So over years, several generations, people thought that women were not as intelligent as men. They were not allowed to vote. They were not even considered completely human,
mm-hmm.
somehow. So all our words, language, literature, science, whatever you say, was written down by men. And they put male's role as first, foremost, right? So hunter-gatherer. But now we have enough researchers who are women also. And they're looking at, okay, which one was getting more calories for the tribe? Which activity? Which activity was possible throughout the year? What was happening? And they figured that it was gathering, which gave the day-to-day daily bread, so to speak. And hunting provided a lot of protein suddenly for the whole tribe, but it was not successful all the time. You couldn't rely on that all the time. And women also hunted, even pregnant women would hunt. Right? And you don't really have to hunt huge animals, though of course that was a bonanza, but small animals, small eggs and, you know, and fishing, all of that could be done by women as well. So once my survival is dependent on you, then I can't claim equality.
Mm-hmm.
How can I claim that I'm equal to you when I'm like, spread out my hands and say, give me food to eat? So this concept of the householder came. The householder is the origin of the word husband. You have animal husbandry, right? What's an animal husbandry? Animal householder. So the man had his land.
The one who holds the land, who owns the house.
Yeah, and he built a house on it. And he's living in it. But he can't cultivate it all by himself. There's no machinery.
Right.
You need people.
Mm-hmm.
And there are all these women. Where are they all going, right? So I can live with as many women as I please. They will work on my land. That's the deal. They will all work on my land. They will help to produce the food. They can eat the food. Their sexuality has not yet been controlled. They were free to have sex with anyone. Because it was not like a suddenly moment in history. It was a whole process. It probably took hundreds of years, this transition from nomadic lifestyle to settlers. There's a book called The Women in Pre-Vedic India that describes so much of this, what I'm talking about. So this woman now, slowly what started happening is that they were having sex. They were also having sex with the householder, the husband. And sometimes the children would resemble him and sometimes they would resemble somebody else. Right? So over time, and also with domestication of animals,
mm-hmm.
they figured the link between sex and babies. that link was not clear earlier. Because we would have sex all the time, but only sometimes some women would get pregnant. So it was not a very clear link, unlike in other other non-human animals. They have a breeding season. So they could observe animals up close and they said, hey, there's a link between sex and babies.
Right.
And then the clampdown began. You can't go out of the house. You can't go beyond the fields. You have this boundary. You stay within that.
Mm-hmm.
No sex with anybody else. And I can't trust you. So you're not to look at other men. And other men shouldn't look at you. So cover yourself. Then inside you stay. Still, you may feel sexual, no? All those feelings. So let's make it bad. Good women don't have sexual feeling.
Mm.
It's bad. If you're interested in sex, you're a bad woman.
Right.
And virginity.
Mm.
This whole idea of virginity is so, it's so strange,
right? Yeah.
It's just a piece of tissue. That hymen is an embryological remnant.
Which also doesn't persist even beyond puberty, right? For many, many women.
It will break. Sometimes it breaks very early. Sometimes it's not there at all. Sometimes very large. The opening is very large. Sometimes very small. Sometimes just by gymnastics, yoga, horse riding, whatnot, it can break, tear. Anyway, this came about that you should be a virgin and don't derive any sexual pleasure. So let's cut the clitoris. That's the female genital mutilation. That goes on even today, even in India, and people defend it, saying it's a tradition. So that's what happened. Virginity became a virtue.
Just the clitoris itself, it doesn't have any other function, right? Like the penis carries urine and it has excretory functions, but the clitoris is largely a sexual or
I'm glad you asked this question because, well, to say the function of the clitoris is only to give sexual pleasure, hello, excuse me, that's the main part, right? Because sexual activity as such puts two individuals who are fairly grown up into a little risky situation in a jungle, for example, right? So if there is a sudden attack, these two people can't just immediately get up and run.
Yeah.
Then sex also carries with it the risk of sexually transmitted infections that you may get. So it's a risky activity. Why would anyone do it if they didn't feel that desire? You know, that sensation. So that sensation is the driving force here. And that is driven by nerves, like many other things. Like you can taste because the nerves are there. You can see because the nerves are there. You can hear because the nerves are there.
Yeah.
So you can be sexual because the nerves are there.
Yeah.
And the nerves are concentrated in the clitoris, in the female, because to distribute them all around would make childbirth excruciating.
Right.
So it's tucked away there. Most of the clitoris is actually inside in the female. In the male, it's the same structures, but they are drawn out.
Mm-hmm.
The entire clitoris is now drawn out. The urethra is elongated, not to pass urine, but to ejaculate the sperms as close to the egg as possible, which in mammals is inside the body, right? And then the skin, which is in the labia minora, gets wrapped around this elongated urethra and the elongated clitoris. That's why you don't have hair on the penis and there's no hair on the labia minora,
mm-hmm.
because they come from the same source.
They're analogous,
analogous,
right?
As parts. Yes. And then the labia majora become the scrotal sacs.
Right.
There's no need for a vagina because only sperms are coming out and they're really tiny, they can come out in the urine. So nature is very frugal that way. It will not make anything which is not required.
Right.
No? Like the tongue is used for so many things.
Right.
Same way the penis is used to pass sperms as well as urine. But in the female, we need a separate passage because a huge 3 kg baby, if it was trying to come out of the urethra, you will have a problem with continence. So we have a separate vagina connected to the uterus there.
I'm thinking about what you said a little earlier about the taller males, the males with more muscle. So there were these physical characteristics that were directly related to how much they could own, what they could take possession of. And isn't it so fascinating to think today, if you look on a dating app, a lot of people will put their height on it as a sort of selling point. And there are many women who will not date a man who is shorter than them. And a Google search will tell you that this is because women feel more protected by taller males, or that they somehow exude the capacity to protect. And this seems to have roots in something that happened thousands and thousands of years ago. It has no bearing today because we don't necessarily need, we don't live in those same structures. But our sexuality is still somehow tied to that history.
It will remain tied. It will remain. You can't discount it altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Because the height is produced by the testosterone continuing to act on the bones. Why is more testosterone needed? Well, it has to be there. It is required for that sperm production,
mm-hmm.
right? And all the secondary sexual characteristics. And if you strip a man of all his secondary sexual characteristics, no hair on the face.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may like a clean-shaven man, but a clean shaven man.
Mm.
If I told you this man has never sprouted any hair at all, you would probably immediately lose interest, because something will tell you inside that, hello, is there sperms here? So a lot of testosterone effects, estrogen effects are there in our bodies, and these are secondary sexual characteristics, and nobody has to tell you that you should feel attracted towards them. To which secondary sexual characteristics you will feel attracted is there in your brain from the time you were born. For many of us, this setting is for heterosexual, but for quite a few of us, it is homosexual. And there are PET scans showing how the brain is getting aroused by that same pheromone, which a female is getting attracted to. This homosexual male is also getting aroused by that same pheromones. Yeah. They can't help it.
This is so interesting. Also, because it brings us back to the thread about the drives that we already have and how our sexual behavior is not only sensory after a point. There are ideas, there is also the influence of what we see around us, and that can't exclude media, pornography, everything that we consume. And it makes me wonder about how, if these drives are sort of in our brain, if they're hardwired into us, but often their expression, it could be violent, or maybe there's shame and we don't express. Is there a possibility to unlearn and then relearn our own sexual behavior and sexual expression?
It's a very beautiful question you ask, because that is what we discuss in our sessions with adolescents in schools and colleges. What we call beautiful, right? It's the symmetry, is a proportion on the face and the body, because it is one of the markers of health of a person. There are several genetic and other disorders where this symmetry is lost, this proportion is very different, and we don't innately feel attracted towards that. So this feeling of attraction, which is based on all this symmetry and proportion, nobody has to tell you, you have a sense of it. You will say, that person is so beautiful. That attraction we call beauty, is that person is so beautiful. Now you go up to that person, sit down next to them, they take one look at you and turn their face away and say, huh, is your experience beautiful still? You may probably feel rejected by this very beautiful looking person. So what we want is a beauty that makes you feel also beautiful.
It needs to be reciprocal.
Yeah, I'm not saying that two beautiful people should get together. What I'm saying is that this physical beauty is not enough for us to sustain us or sustain our relationship through life. Today you are very beautiful. I get attracted to you. I fawn all over you. You are very favorable to me. We both agree and like we are together. And the next day you have an accident. You're gone. Your face is gone. So when we asked some of the boys this, what would you do? Leave her, ma'am. Right? Leave her. Right? So I'm talking about that. For humans, our experience is given not only by just by the body, but also by the body language. Not by the look of your eyes, but also the look in your eyes. Because we are very intelligent and we have far too many perceptions.
Interesting, because we talk about, you know, someone that you look at and feel attracted towards as an object of desire. But even in what you're saying now, it sounds very much like you want that person to be a subject. You want them to be active. You want to see something alive in them and directed towards you in them. And that can further your connection with them.
Yeah, yeah. Because you want to dance. Till now you've been dancing alone. Mm. Now you want to dance together. Right? Not dance on somebody.
This series was made possible with the generosity and knowledge of Dr. Sangeeta Saxena and the contributions of Abha Khetarpal, Dipankar Pant, Diya Naidu, Meghna Roy, Mitch Gupta, Nitya Devaya, and Saurabh Levin. We thank Vikram Bhatt and the team at the Bangalore International Center for their support. Safe Spaces was produced by Gaurav Krishna and Ishan Gupta. I am Anisha Tawag. Thank you for listening.